Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to this week's Lift Ahead podcast at Unusual Date and Time. I'm Mike Ball. I also blog at leftahead.com and harumpher.com. And we're expecting Jessica Burson today, author of The Naked Results, How Exotic Dance Became Big Business. And I'll warn you flat off, if we're chatty, it's because we and our families have known each other socially for some years, so we're not strangers. Jessica was a scholar getting her graduate degree, and she had a distant college, so she did not get a chance to get the usual TA jobs. Jessica, are you on?
I am, yes.
Excellent. So I was just about to say, so you didn't get your usual TA opportunities, so you had to have some money. So you ended up, you were not some waif on the street who was sucked into a life of seaminess and so forth, but you, in fact, were, you wanted to make some money to get your graduate degree.
That's right.
So you,
that's right.
You did exotic dancing at two clubs in Connecticut for a year. It wasn't a career, but it was, you know, you got into it and you made some money. But you're a scholar. You teach dance studies at Yale and have it in the UK and
that's right.
Harvard and other places. And Pilates, too. Didn't you teach? I think you said it.
Yes, I did teach Pilates. I was actually teaching Pilates while I was stripping. But that, you know, was not nearly as lucrative. So.
Well, it's got to be a lot better than a fast food joint, I'm sure.
Yes,
anyway,
absolutely.
So people should be aware. I have links to The Naked Result on both the Left Ahead site and the Blog Talk Radio site. So they're there, and I urge people to buy it. We have. We enjoyed it.
Great.
You're going to be a bit surprised, I believe. You come with a stereotype that anything written about any sex work of any type is going to be a woe is me and
right.
life terrible and that kind of stuff like that. And this isn't one of those. And it's there are vignettes in there, and you do have results of interviews and conversations with other dancers. But it also it's not salacious. So there are some fun things in there and a few sad things in there. But it's there's a fair amount of history and scholarship. So if people are coming into it, it's not the usual strip club book, that's for sure. But
it's,
there is
yeah,
a heavy...
Yeah, it was not meant to be a memoir. You know what I mean? I think there's a whole genre of stripper memoirs out there, and some of them are what you're saying, some of them are the kind of tragic stories, and some aren't. But, yeah, this was more meant to be kind of an analysis of the industry.
And people will be a bit surprised about it. There are phrases in there that surprise me, but I came from a business background, but I'm listening to that.
Oh, really?
The,
okay.
The McDonaldization of stripping and kind of stuff like that. And
yeah.
How and the business, the subtitle of the book, and how chains and business are taking over and changing the nature. And, in fact, the two clubs that you worked at in Connecticut were quite a bit different. And one of them was part of a larger chain. And I mean, it was down to, the most amazing thing in the book was you talk about 45 and 80-page contracts that the dancers have to sign.
Yep.
Micromanaging seemed to be the order of the day.
Exactly. And the micromanaging that the big chains do is actually, I think, maybe their eventual undoing because of all these class action suits against them. So, you know, there have been a bunch of suits against the management of these clubs by dancers, arguing that because of that micromanagement, they're employees.
Mm-hmm.
They're not independent contractors. And that, you know, that's most of those cases have been successful. So, it's not like those chains are going to close down anytime soon, but I have hope that things might actually change. Yeah.
Better for the dancers, you think?
I hope so. I mean, a lot of dancers actually think that being an independent contractor is better for them because then they don't have to necessarily be upfront about their taxes. And they have more control over their own work. Mm-hmm. But I think that, you know, because of that McDonaldization, because of that micromanagement, they don't really have that control anymore anyway.
So when you got into this, I told people that we and our families have known each other socially for several years. So I just,
yes.
It seems that you said that your boyfriend at the time, who is now your husband and father of your children, was very supportive and comfortable. That does not fit a stereotype of a typical American male being insecure, but he felt secure in his manhood?
I mean, so many of the dancers that I worked with had boyfriends or girlfriends.
Yeah.
And I never heard anything about any of them being jealous, to be honest.
Huh.
I mean, the stories that I heard were more, you know, at the first club I worked at, actually, there were these, you know, two very beautiful sisters, and one of the three owners of the club was quite infatuated with them. And when he found out that one of them had a boyfriend, he was the one who was insecure and fired her. You know, but I never heard any stories about the boyfriends being insecure. You know, I think if you're in a remotely healthy relationship, and you know your partner is doing sex work, you have to be okay with it. But yeah, so, you know, my partner at the time is still my partner now, Matthew. Like, he was totally down with it and, you know, rode his bike to come see me.
Okay.
I thought there was something really charming about him riding a bike through New Haven.
Was there bike
at night
parking at the club?
Well, I'm sure he just, you know, locked it up, you know, against a signpost or something. But no, I mean, biking was not as common back then. And yeah, he was supportive of me trying it. He was supportive of me doing it. And then when I decided it was time to stop, he was supportive of that too. So, yeah.
Okay. So now you did talk about the other dancers and their relationships. It seems like more like aspirations seem to be more of a theme in there. Particularly, you talked about one woman who wanted to go to American Samoa and find great love. And you knew it was a fantasy, but it was a harmless fantasy. Did many of the women seem to feel they were destined for better things? Because that wasn't a long-term career for people who age out?
It was, the aging out issue, I think, is a really big issue. And it's something that different people handle really differently. I would say I really didn't get to know dancers at the second club, at the corporate club, so I can't really speak about their experiences. But at the other club, I think probably 2/3 of the people there were not intending to be there forever. People were in school, people had internships. I think a lot of the dancers, the younger dancers, imagined, you know, doing this for, I don't know, 5 years, saving up some money, and then going back to school, you know. There was a range, but, you know, and for some, like, I wrote about this one woman, Heather, who this was like her post-career. Like, she'd been a Montessori teacher, and then when she'd had her own kids, she and her husband decided they didn't want to do daycare, and that meant somebody had to work at night and somebody had to work in the day. And so she was doing this completely pragmatically, you know, with completely no illusions about what it was. There was a population there of women, like, where this was their career. And there was one I remember who was sort of clearly heading towards the twilight, let's say, of her dancing career. And I think it was really hard, you know, I think it was hard because she didn't know what else to do afterwards. Yeah.
I think your book reminded me, years ago, I lived in Manhattan, one of my high school chums was there, and she and a number of her friends worked another side of the sex industry, which was the massage clubs in the Wall Street area.
Oh, yeah.
And the men there would come off at lunch or after work, and these also weren't brothels, but the guys came there to be masturbated, is what it amounted to.
Right.
And it was an odd thing. It says that they're the women all. I knew her and several of the women, and they were laughing about how these men were, you know, daytime, rich, powerful, good-looking, wearing their fancy suits, and they would come in there to be controlled by women, and they were convinced that it was because they had all these control issues. And they didn't want to be in control all the time. Did you have a sense of that, like, during lap dances? Was this, like, control an issue in there?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, it's funny. Like, that's a there are guys, and I think it would be a mistake to really generalize about this and say like, okay, well, all those mm-hmm. high power guys, what they really want is to be dominated. You know, I think that's a stereotype too. But definitely there's differences in how men want to participate in the lap dance. You know, it's like mm-hmm. so some people want to tell you what to do and, you know, mm-hmm. dance like this, do this, you know, show me that. And then other people really just want to let you do your own thing. So I think it varies. But, yeah, control is definitely a part of it. You know, I think there's other parts of the industry in terms of, like, you know, dominatrixes and things like that. So, like, if you really yeah. want to be controlled and you really want to give up, you know, give up your agency to a woman, there, you know, there's plenty of places to go do that, too.
And one thing I didn't see in there is there seemed to be a difference between the allegedly classier mm-hmm. chain joints, but there wasn't a mention of whether they were more fetishized areas or dancers where if men wanted, you know, what, gigantic breasts or you
right.
did mention Carol Dodot at one point in there, or I don't know, whatever, women who look like girls, you know, whatever. Is fetishism a part of that, or is it more homogenized?
Well, that's part of, I think, what's happening with this process of being taken over by corporations is that it is mm-hmm. becoming much more homogenized. There are still some kind of niche clubs. There's a place I heard of in L.A. called Jumbo's, which is, you know, for guys who want bigger ladies. There are, you know, but, yeah, in terms of other, yeah, going to see, yeah, no, there's not. I mean, I don't think in stripping there is as much of that as in,
right.
you know, prostitution or some other sorts
uh-huh.
of aspects of the industry. Yeah. And whatever, you know, whatever room there is for that, I think is getting kind of squeezed out.
Hmm. Yeah, well, I gotta say, for people who, when they get the book, they should be aware they're going to learn a lot about kinesiology and other motion, and I was
yeah.
it was, you know, some of it was news to me because I've studied some of this. I was a jock, and I, you know, I get some of this stuff. But, you know, your description of how movement informs both the dancer and the viewers was largely new to me. You know, very informative. I think
great.
People should be aware of that. And you talked too about how, when you watch another exotic dancer, how you basically can really feel it, and you can sense what she's doing with her body and whether it, you know, what the aim of it is. So people should be aware of that. They should be aware that also, I mean, you're pretty specific about what goes on in lap dance, and for people who've never seen one, experienced one, I mean, that's going to be considerable news. Now, I got in there, it seemed like the lap dance, as you described it, would be much more frustrating for the dancer person, the person being danced for, than being cathartic. Is that is that an issue?
Yes, I think, you know, I think most of the time that's true. I mean, I think sometimes, I mean, there are times where the customer fulfills his aim, let's say, right, during
right.
the dance.
Uh-huh.
But most of the time, I would, you know, most of the time, yeah. And I think that contradiction kind of speaks to the difference
mm-hmm.
between stripping and having, you know, prostitution, which, you know, I think
right.
they're on a continuum. But and I'm not, you know, I'm not trying to say one is better than the other, but
mm-hmm.
there's something about the you know, having this fantasy about the woman that's dancing for you.
Hmm.
That's different from the reality, you know, and I think the fantasy is what brings people into the club. And so for that fantasy to keep going, in a way, you can't actually fulfill it because then it's not
right.
a fantasy, you know. So you have to,
uh-huh.
that frustration, I think, is actually very appealing to certain types of people.
And you would say, lap dance, again, for people who've never been in such a club, but you might perform multiple lap dances for the same person the same year. Just, you know,
oh,
yes,
absolutely.
Here's another $20. Let's do another one.
Yep. That's the goal. I mean, you
uh-huh.
know, just the $20 is like, that's not, you know, yeah, your goal uh-huh. is to, is to keep that fantasy alive and to kind of keep them on the hook and having them, you know, yeah. So every time there's a new song, it counts as a new dance and you get another $20. So, yeah, that's how you make money.
And so then the regular customers may very well see you three times a week or something like that? I mean, more than once?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, there's different ways people do it. But, yeah, definitely, you know, some guys, there were a few guys who came into the club every night. I mean, I didn't work a regular schedule, so like I came in at different
right.
nights, different weeks. But yeah, there were people I saw there every single time, so I'm pretty sure they were just there every night. But yeah, there's definitely, you know, people try to find out when you're going to be on, and they'll come to see you a couple times a week for sure. Yeah.
And something else, people, the readers can be aware of how much you get into the acting of it, the deep acting.
Mm-hmm.
And how much it's, and you make some comparisons to, flight attendants, for example. There are other people who aren't necessarily delighted with everything that goes on and all of their customers,
right.
all their interactions.
Right.
But deep acting is an important part of it. You have to feel like you understand the client and are performing in the way that is most titillating or satisfying or both to him.
Yeah, I think, you know, it sort of depends on the client, and I think I mentioned this in the book, that, you know, there are people who are not nice, and so
right.
you give them, you know, 10% of yourself or something, you know. You're
uh-huh.
doing, you're not doing deep acting with them. And the whole deep acting, surface acting thing, I should say, comes from this book by Arlie Hochschild called The Managed Heart, where she studied flight attendants. But, yeah, I mean, there's this idea that in any kind of service work, you're doing emotional labor. You know, you're doing,
mm-hmm.
you know, the flight attendant is calming people down and, you know, trying to make people feel okay about being on the flight, and probably a lot less so now than when she wrote that book.
Mm-hmm.
having, you know, if you've ever been on an airplane recently, there's not that much
yeah.
of that going on.
Yeah.
But, you know, in terms of the stripping, I think, it, you know, there were some, like your regular, the, you know, a person who's a regular client, yeah, you're going to be doing this deep acting with him where you're not just trying to convince him that there's intimacy. You're also trying to convince yourself, you know,
mm-hmm.
Because that's really the only way to do it convincingly and fulfillingly, I think, for that type of client. For, you know, the frat guys who come in on Friday night drunk off their asses, like you're not necessarily going to be doing a whole lot of that kind of work with them, you know, because they don't deserve it, basically.
Hmm. So do they, does the deep acting, is that the route to the best tips in the business, both on the stage
and
lap dance?
I think it just depends. I mean, I think, yeah, in a way, I think yes. I mean, I think the women who are able to make the men feel special,
mm-hmm.
And make them feel like they're really you know, that the key thing seems to be that a lot of guys, again, not the guys who just kind of float in there once in a while, but the regular customers are going there mm-hmm. for emotional intimacy, really
mm-hmm.
more than anything physical. And so if you can really kind of go with them to some place where they feel like they are being heard and seen and validated, yeah, absolutely, that's going to be the best tips for sure.
So, but that doesn't lead to demands or requests for an actual relationship outside the club?
I think it does all the time, you know, but the dancer almost inevitably will say no.
Yeah.
You know, I did hear stories about people not dating, but, you know, hooking up with guys from the club. But that's,
mm-hmm.
I mean, it's in almost every club that's at least what's the word? You know, it's disallowed, at least in name, right? Even if
mm-hmm.
the club encourages people to go out and do extras, but officially, you're not allowed to date people from the club. But, you know, most dancers just have no interest in actually dating any of these people. You know, they mostly have their own companions to go home to. So it's more about play acting and fantasy, I think.
Yeah, speaking of that, you wrote very tellingly a couple times in there of this being the third place. Which is kind
yep.
of a standard lingo there about it's not home, it's not work, but
mm-hmm.
it's someplace else. It's a new, a different reality.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that third place idea, the original concept of it was that it was a place for a kind of community gathering, you know, the pub, the coffee shop, the bookstore, whatever. And, I mean, the strip club definitely can function that way. And if you think about the way lots of times men go to strip clubs in groups, right, and it's kind of partly about their bonding as well. But, you know, I as I said, like, you know, no one thinks about Starbucks as being a third place where, like, communities gather and friendships get, you know. Like, that's just not a story that we have anymore about coffee shops. So I think the same thing is happening with strip clubs, too.
All right, now, you also, during that acting part, how did you discern a client's romantic style? You mentioned that phrase a couple times, and you have a... Is this kind of a magic skill that you pick up?
No. I don't think there's anything magic. I mean, I think it's exactly the same. It's the same senses that you turn on if you are, you know, if you go to a bar and you want to date somebody, you know, or you want to pick somebody up. It's just sort of paying attention to what, how the person talks to you, how they move, what sorts of things they want to talk about. You know, I think I mentioned in the book having somebody come in, and this was a long time ago, right? So this was during the Iraq War, and having someone come in and just start going on about how great George Bush was. You know, nothing could be further from my own feelings, but, you know, just being like, okay, that's you. You want to talk about politics. I'm going to, and you want me to go along with you, and so that's what we're going to do. You know, I'm not going to argue with him. And, you know, there were other people who didn't want to talk about themselves at all. They wanted to ask me about my life, which is always interesting because you're encouraged to make stuff up. You know, you're not really supposed to tell everything about yourself. But, you know, so there's just in the same way that when you go on a date with somebody, you're picking up on cues all the time. I think, it, you know, there's nothing magic about it. It's just sort of human behavior, you know.
And you spoke a lot about the physicality of the dancers in particular. And I was surprised at one point. I came pointing, why doesn't she talk about the olfactory? There's no smell in here. But then all of a sudden it was in the book at one point, but it was a very small thing. It kind of surprised me because my cliche is I've noticed that women are a whole lot better with smells than men are. I mean, men can do visual great in general. But I can say, you know, women catch smells, they differentiate, they remember them. It's really sort of amazing. The olfactory.
Do you think it breaks down that way? Because, like, I have to say, in my own life, my husband and my brother too smell things much better than me.
Oh, really? Huh.
No, I don't actually have a good sense of smell at all. Yeah.
One of my managers had what I thought of as a woman's sense of smell. He was just really, really good at it. But he was unusual. And several of us, other in the tech writing business, said, Dick can really smell things. Guys
Gosh, that's
smell
weird.
Things.
Yeah.
It is, but one of my three sons, my youngest, Isaac, is very, very good with it. And, you know, we used to have a chef who lived around the corner here. And at some point when we were walking around or driving around, and I said something about it, how I could be cooking something, and Isaac would just walk in, and he could tell me exactly what herbs I was cooking with, and not gross ones like oregano, but subtle ones.
Right.
Like, okay, that's really good. But it, I tend to think that is unusual, and I've known quite a few women who are very good olfactorily, and I'm so-so.
Right.
My stereotype is that it's more of a woman skill. Anyway, that's my thing. Okay.
Well, I know, just in terms of the smell of the strip clubs, I'll just say that, you know, again, this was a while back, so everyone was smoking in the club at the time. So that's the, you know, smoke and beer is pretty much, at least at the kind of the working class club, that's, you really couldn't smell much beyond that. So.
Yeah, well, I go back to the time when airplanes were full of smoke, too.
Oh,
so I remember
That
was the worst, because if you end up, somehow
you can't get out of that.
Plane, all of it, and you got off, and all of your clothes smelled like somebody else's cigarettes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I could do without too. So, you were talking in terms about the physicality again. Did you find now, as a teaching dance studies, did you find that the year of the club informed or was informed by your other dancing?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, I think in both directions. I think being having I trained in modern dance for years, so like having some sense of where my body is in space, like a lot of people say that, stripping isn't dancing, but in fact, there's quite a bit of dancing going on. So if you can dance, that certainly helps. But I think it also it kind of it tuned me into aspects of movement that, are part of the modern dance tradition, but really not as emphasized or not as personal. Sort of having a lower center of gravity and being connected to the ground and all that kind of stuff. And then there's the pole, which is not something that we have in modern dance, which definitely, I don't know if I would say it influenced my movement later because you can't really do it without it, but it gives you, I think it must be a little bit like some of the things that they do in gymnastics. Like you can have this kind of freedom of momentum with that pole that you can't have with anything else. So it's definitely very fun.
Well, I saw that in the book. You're saying you were implying that there were other dancers who were much more adept with the pole, and they were just more
Oh,
gymnastic.
yes. Yes. I mean, people do incredible things on the pole. On the pole, there's actually, pole dancing has taken off now as kind of a fitness thing, and there's worldwide competitions. If you go on YouTube and just, Google pole dance competition, you'll see some incredible, incredible stuff. And I never could do any of that. Like, I never did gymnastics, so I don't have that kind of upper body strength. But, even just the simplest things that you can do, like I said, it just gives you a sense of freedom. That it's sort of like being on a swing. You know what I mean? That's the closest thing I can compare it to. Yeah. So no, I never did the gymnastics. I really admire the people who can. But I think it actually takes quite a bit of training and work to do that.
Well, I was a bit surprised to see your several mentions of the trend toward it being like a suburban, like a
Yep.
suburban moms kind of thing, where they're all of a sudden they're doing it for each other or their husbands or whatever. But it's like,
Yep.
it's kind of like a trendy thing, which, well, it's not in my house.
Right.
I was kind of
Right.
surprised to see that. I went out and I looked at a couple of the sites that you mentioned in there, and I was like, I was really quite surprised, and it's being co-opted by the minivan moms.
Yep.
It's a surprise to me.
There's actually been a debate online a little bit about this. So a number of the companies and the sort of gurus who do the pole dance as fitness had this hashtag not a stripper because they're really trying to divorce pole dancing from stripping and really make sure everyone knows, oh no, it's just not dirty and doesn't, I'm not a stripper, I'm not like those slutty girls. And then just recently I saw that there's now a hashtag yes a stripper. Because a lot of exotic dancers are like, this is where that movement form came from. Get over yourself, kind of, acknowledge it, stop demonizing us. We're not your enemy and you took these moves from us, so that's fine, but acknowledge that. Yeah,
Well, it may,
it's a strange development for something like that. But if you think about it too, I mean, honestly, I've never understood why there's like what is sexy about the pole. Pole dancing is not sexy. I don't understand why it's in strip clubs or why it started in strip clubs. I've heard different explanations. Somebody recently told me that it was something to do with like sideshows in the 20s and women using the tents on pole, the pole tent, sorry, the poles for tents. But in a way it makes just as much sense for suburban moms to be doing it as anybody else, 'cause it's not a very erotic thing to do.
Yeah, and it may be that, we are living in New England and have a tradition of Puritanism and so forth, but I don't know many people at this era who don't think it's okay for partners or husbands and wives or spouses of either type to not be sexy with each other. So I don't know. It doesn't seem like a yeah. It could be stripping. That's okay.
Right.
All right. All right. I think we've come to the end. You've wasted another perfectly good half hour, as Click and Clack used to say. I appreciate
right.
that. I will put the citations out there. I do urge people to buy your book.
Excellent.
And,
thank you.
Well, a combination of scholarship. There's history in there. There's, you know, there's discussions of architecture. There's all kinds of stuff as well. And, you know, dancing from, you know, every aspect of exotic, erotic dancing. And I think that's an education and enjoyment. Plus, there are personal vignettes in there, the other dancers and yourself, and so people can get it from all angles. And there is straight scholarship,
yeah.
and there is history, and there is personal. And
I
appreciate it.
Point out for Boston listeners that there's a chapter on the combat zone, which was kind of the most fun one to write. But there's also some great pictures in that chapter too. So yeah.
All right. Well, thank you very much for coming on.
I really enjoyed
your book, and I hope everybody gets it. All right.
Oh, thank you so much.
Thank you. Okay.
Okay.
Goodbye. Bye.